and steadfast, penetrating, and perfect Dharma, is rarely met with even 100,000 million kalpas, having it to see and listen to remember and accept. I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning. Well, every while, whether it's a year, sometimes there are a couple years. I don't know why I wait so long. I like to read the Satipatthana Sutra and just go over it with you a little bit. And I can't remember the last time I actually did it, but it's really in the, considered one of the most important, some people consider it the most important sutra, short little section. And this is from in the Digha-Nikaya, the long discourses of the Buddha. It's found, sutra is actually found at a few places in the Pali Canon. So, I think really probably the two most important sutras are really the Satipatthana Sutra. And what the Satipatthana Sutra is saying is establishing the four foundations of mindfulness. So what it's basically saying is it's the seminal teachings of Buddha. He's saying, sit down and pay attention. Sit down and just pay attention and see what you can learn from your body. And see what you can learn by paying attention to your body and your feelings and your mind and your states of mind. See what that teaches you. See what happens when that teaches you. And then the second sutra, which I thought maybe we'd end with today, because we haven't done a remembrance ceremony for a while, a well-being ceremony for people that could use some help or that have passed, is the Heart Sutra. And so the Heart Sutra actually builds on the Satipatthana Sutra. The Heart Sutra, as we know, comes 400 or 500 years later than the original Pali Canon or the original words of Buddha. And what the Heart Sutra is, so if the Satipatthana Sutra is saying, pay attention, be mindful, it's basically establishing the criteria for mindfulness. And what the Heart Sutra is saying is let go. So Satipatthana is saying, pay attention, pay attention, pay attention. And what the Heart Sutra is saying after people have been paying attention for 300 or 400 years, what they're saying is, okay, that's good. You're paying attention to all these things. Now, let's see, go a little bit further. What does that mean that you've been paying attention? You've learned what gets you uptight and what creates conflict and what the hindrances are, what happens when you're restless or if you have too much greed or too much aversion. We realize how you contract, what that does. It keeps you from having a peaceful state of mind. It keeps you from Nirvana, right? But the Heart Sutra is saying, well, let's go a little bit further. Just, what about letting go? What about letting go? Now, of course, in the Satipatthana Sutra, you are letting go. You're letting go from moment to moment. What's the next state of awareness? What's the next state of awareness? It's actually teaching you, one, it's teaching you about impermanence, that by paying attention to your state of mind and your body and your feelings, you begin to see yourself as not so solid as once you thought you were. Any concept that you have is constantly changing. So the Heart Sutra takes it a little bit further. It's saying, yeah, that's true. Whatever idea you have about anything is only temporary. It's just an idea. Let it go. Let it go. Let it go. Let it go. And then it takes it more into, it develops more of the concept of emptiness, meaning emptiness, fullness, in the sense that we're really connected with our, the natural conclusion of this is that we're really all, you can't really divide. These artificial divisions that we have are just arbitrary. So but let's go back to the Satipatthana Sutra and let's read this most important sutra. We won't get through all of it, but we'll get through the at least the first part, and then maybe We'll finish it up in a week or so. So, thus have I heard. So when you hear that, thus I have heard, that's Ananda. That's Buddha's attendant that attended him for 30, 40 years, and that when he died, nothing was written down. And so, you know, 80, 190 years later, they said, you know, maybe we should write this stuff down. So the way the teaching is taught is the elder monks got together, and Ananda, because he was the attendant, he was there at all the discourses, actually had memorized the discourses, and he was the one, so he's the one that's saying, this is what I heard. And so people are writing this down, right? Thus I have heard. Once the Lord was staying among the Kusaras at the market town of theirs called, so market town, Sinners, he actually used to teach. Buddha often would teach. Not only would he live close to urban situations, but he would often teach there. So not only monks would come, but also lay people would come. At a market town called Kama Sadama. And there the Lord addressed the monks. Monks, or lay people? Yes, they replied. And the Lord said, there is, monk, this one way. To the purification of beings, for the overcoming of sorrow and distress, for the disappearance of pain and sadness. So this is the way to pay attention, to be mindful, for the gaining of the right path, for the realization of nirvana. That is to say, the four foundations of mindfulness. What are the four? Here, monks. A monk abides contemplating the body as the body, ardent, clearly aware and mindful, having put aside hankering and fretting for the world. He, and it says he in the early traditions, but when I translate this, I'll say he and she, because that's really what it means. He or she abides contemplating feelings as feelings. He or she abides contemplating mind as mind. He or she abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects. Ardent, clearly aware, and mindful, having put aside hankering and fretting for the world. So we come in the door, we try to put aside all our involvements with the outside world, in the sense of, like, let's just leave our worries and cares outside. Let's dedicate ourselves right now to just paying attention to what is immediately in front of us. The first one, contemplation of the body. Mindfulness of breathing. So remember last week I gave you those four little helpful hints from Thich Nhat Hanh, where I was just saying in, out, slow, calm, deep, relax, smile, release, present moment. Remember we said that? And I said, why don't you just try those? Maybe just one. So those are actually all embedded in the Satipatthana Sutra. That's really where they're coming from. He maybe tweaks it a little bit with a smile release one. You know, the natural result of this is hopefully a sense of well-being and ease, and so you tend to smile a little bit more, and you want to release that, you know, out into the world. But let's see. And how, monks, does a monk abide contemplating the body as the body? Remember, the way all the early sutras are repetitive, because that's the way they were taught. They weren't written down. So the way you memorized it is by these sort of mnemonic devices, about repeating it again and again and again, almost like a chant, you know. And how, monks, does a monk abide contemplating the body as the body? Here, a monk, having gone into the forest or to the root of a tree or to an empty place. In other words, here. An empty place. We create a space without too many distractions, right? Your room, your meditation room. Sits down cross-legged, holding his or her body erect. Posture, it says it right here. Posture is important. Erect. Not slump, but erect. Having established mindfulness before him or her, okay, I'm going to establish it, right? Mindfully, he or she breathes in. Mindfully, he or she breathes out. Mindfully, in a long breath, he knows that he or she breathes in a long breath, and breathing out, he or she is mindful of breathing out a long breath. So I went through, it was really helpful for me, I went through and read the footnotes in this particular commentary. So it was interesting that remember, Buddha drew from meditation traditions, from the Vedic tradition before. And a lot of the Vedic and the Hindu traditions, breath control is a strong part of meditation, which you will say, you breathe in a certain number of breaths, hold it, and you'll breathe out. It's kind of like breathing pranayama. But the way he taught it was, it wasn't about mind control. It was, you just paid attention to it. And that's the way we teach it. In fact, it's interesting, in his commentary, he says actually, even though this is a sutra from the Theravadin tradition, he says the tradition that actually holds the closest to this sutra is actually the Zen tradition. Because Zen, as I've said many times, Zen means in Chinese is Chan. And Chan is an abbreviation for Dhamma. And Jhana means meditation, means deep meditation states. So we're the school that emphasizes meditation. Not all Buddhist schools emphasized meditation. There were some Buddhist schools, and still are, for example, emphasize sutra study. Or like in Sri Lanka, the emphasis was made hundreds of years ago that studying the sutras was more important than meditation practice. And there's some schools called the Vinaya school, where there's a resurgence right now, actually, in China, where they study the precepts, the 256 rules, and if you follow these 256 rules, that's the primary emphasis, not meditation. But in the Zen tradition, meditation, and this was actually the foundation of that, of our tradition, this particular sutra. So you're aware, breathing in a long breath, breathing out a long breath, a short breath, a short breath. So I remember when I would teach you, study meditation, I'd say, well, start off with counting. Just start counting your breath. Be aware. That starts to bring you to the awareness of it. And then often I would encourage you maybe, okay, well, drop the counting. Now see if you can just pay attention, remember I did this a couple of months ago, to the beginning, the middle, and the end of the breath. And I asked, and people said, that's pretty hard to do. It's pretty difficult to actually pay attention to the beginning, middle, and end of the breath. It takes a lot of concentration to do that. But it's good to try that. You know, it would be pretty impossible for most of us to do that for a whole 30-minute period. But if you could do it periodically, it really helps you. Just like all these devices, saying in and out, or deep, relax, it helps you just bringing yourself back to the moment of awareness. Just like today when you were walking, maybe you found just by saying those words, lifting, carrying, placing, maybe you found that your mind was maybe a little less active. So these are all just techniques, helpful little ways that you can bring yourself back. So, but basically what you're doing is trying to be aware of the breath. Beginning, middle, and end. Breathing out. So, he or she trains him or herself thinking, I will breathe in, conscious of my whole body. Not just the breath, but the whole body. Let's see, I have a footnote here. What does it say? Okay. He trains him or herself thinking, I will breathe out, conscious of the whole body. So it isn't just the breath. He's saying it isn't just awareness of the stomach, but you also can expand to the awareness of the whole body. Can you feel your whole body breathing? Can you feel your back breathing? Can you feel your stomach breathing? Can you feel your legs breathing? Sometimes we tend to emphasize a little bit that we anchor here because that's where the primary sensation is. But you can expand. Just imagine feeling your whole body breathing through not just your nose, but through all the pores of your body. So when your concentration becomes more refined, you can actually have that extent, that experience of just breath. You know, where's breath and where's body? Where's the distinction? He trains himself thinking, I will breathe out, conscious of the whole body. He trains himself thinking, I will breathe in, calming the whole body process. He trains himself thinking, I will breathe out, calming the whole body process. So here was the place where Thich Nhat Hanh was saying, breathing in, deep ease, deep relax. So that's, he's taking it from this particular section of the Satipatthana Sutra. So you can actually say that. I'm actually, that's what's happening. And that's your physical experience, right? When you're meditating. That you actually, if you do pay attention, and you're dropping your thoughts, you do become calmer. The mental factors, you know, of aversion or greed or whatever is moving you towards or away from something, restlessness, things begin to calm. So you actually are calming your body. Just as a skilled turner or his assistant, in making a long turn knows he is making a long turn, or in making a short turn knows he is making a short turn. So he's using a very specific example that people at that particular time could really relate to. Right? So too a monk in breathing in a long breath knows that he's breathing in a long breath, and trains himself. So this is how we call it practice. So we're actually training ourselves to be mindful. I will breathe out, calming the whole body process. And what happens when you do this? So the next chapter he says, insight. So he abides, contemplating body as body internally, and contemplating body as body externally. So, you know, for years I didn't know what that meant. What does it mean, contemplating your body internally and externally? What does that actually mean? So I always thought for years, I mean years, I'm talking 30 years, I thought it meant, well, you know, we don't, when we're the body, we can actually be aware of how, what the sensations of the breath, but we can have some sense of what's happening internally in our organs. You know, you actually feel the blood flowing. So that's internal. And external would be how it is, like say, externally on your skin, how the air and the movement. That's what I thought it meant. And I think it does mean that. But in this commentary, it actually means aware of other people's bodies. Now that's pretty fascinating that it actually means that. Because it, he says not only when you get to body, but it also mind. You're aware of mind internally, and you're aware of mind externally. You're aware of mind states internally, and you're aware of mind states externally. So that's actually very profound. I mean, I was kind of amazed when I read that. And what it actually means is you're aware of other people's mind states. It actually means that you're telepathic, that when you're sitting in this room, that it's not just being isolated in yourself, that you are aware, you're aware of other, how other people are sitting, which is true, right? If everybody's restless in this room, you feel that restlessness, right? If everybody's calm and their minds are calm, you feel it. We're all connected. So in that one phrase, actually, we're sort of taking it now really more to what the Heart Sutra is saying. That we're really all connected. So just that one phrase I thought was pretty interesting. So, he or she abides contemplating phenomena. So the phenomena of the sensations of your body seems pretty mundane, right? Nothing too exotic about that. But by just continually observing the phenomena, the sensations of your body, and what's happening in your mind, you're beginning to gain insight. Not only are you calming the body, which is why most of us come to meditation. Really. We come because we're a little frantic and we want to just chill out. So we notice by paying attention to our breath and calming our body, we actually can calm our body and our minds. Our mind slows down, our body becomes more relaxed. Wow, what a fantastic thing, right? But we begin to contemplate the arising and falling of phenomena. And what does that mean? It means, what kind of insight do we gain in that? What important insight do we begin to gain in that? the insight of impermanence, right? That's why in Vipassana, what the word Vipassana means is insight. It means by doing this practice, you're gaining insight into impermanence. What profound influence does that have? That all your mental states are impermanent. It means that actually you're a verb rather than a noun. And because you think you're a noun, that's what gets you into trouble all the time. You're the solid sense of self that you're constantly protecting rather than just a momentary state that's just coming and going like, what's the big deal? So this is very profound, what we're talking about here. Because it's leading us to a deep insight into the three marks of Buddhism, which is impermanence, no self, and basically, don't hang on to anything, because if you hang on to it, it's going to create suffering. If you try to make something solid and permanent that isn't, you're going to suffer, which is true, right? And you gain that insight by sitting down and observing body phenomena and mental phenomena and feeling phenomena. That's how you actually observe it. Rising, falling, and you get to calm yourself down, you get to be relaxed, and you begin to have a feeling of well-being and ease that arises. What a benefit, right? What a bonus. It's a whole package that you get. So, or else mindfulness that there is a body is present to him just to the extent necessary for knowledge or awareness. Just to the extent necessary. So that means you're not tripping out on all this. You're not sitting there going into a discursive feeling about, you know, what the three marks are. No, you're just noticing it. You're just noticing rising, falling. Just to the extent necessary. And he or she abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. And that monks is how a monk abides contemplating the body in the body. Now, let's go further. So we're sitting down and we do this. What happens when we get up? Do we just forget it? Or do we only do this when we do sitting meditation? No. We do this in all the postures, in all the activities of our daily life. This is not so easy. Again, a monk, when walking, knows that he or she is walking. When standing, knows that she or she is standing. When sitting, knows that he is sitting. When lying down, knows he is lying down. In whatever way his body is disposed, he knows that that's how it is. So he abides contemplating body as body internally, both internally and externally. Internally and externally again. And he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world, again, reinforcing impermanence, letting go, right? And that, monks, is how a monk abides, contemplating body in a body. Again, a monk, when going forward or back, is clearly aware of what he or she is doing. In looking forward or back, she is clearly aware of what he is doing. In bending or stretching, he is clearly aware of what he is doing. In carrying his inner and outer robe and his bowl, is clearly aware of what he is doing. In eating, drinking, chewing, and savoring, he is clearly aware of what he is doing. In passing excrement and urine, he or she is aware of what he is doing. In walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, in speaking and staying silent, he or she is clearly aware of what he is doing. So there you go. So when we say our practice in everyday life, it clearly means that it isn't just sitting on a cushion. It's like taking this sense of awareness into our everyday life. And there are practices, various practices that help us do that. One is little gathas that we do. So when we, before we eat, we do a blessing, you know. Venerate the three treasures. We give thanks for this food, the work of many people, suffering of other forms of life. We're aware, as we eat, we're actually eating the whole world, you know. Or when we go to the bathroom, in Zen monasteries, you say a little gata before you go to the bathroom. Washing body and mind, you know, may I let go of defilements. May I purify my body and my mind. So when you're washing, you're actually aware of the sensation of washing, but you're also trying to create a sense of why you're doing this. You're doing this to liberate yourself and all beings. So that's one practice. In the Vipassana tradition, one of the practices is, traditional practices, what I gave you this morning. When you walk, you just don't walk. Lifting, carrying, placing. They actually do that when you eat. Lifting, carrying, placing, chewing, swallowing. They actually do that. And you may want to do that practice for, I find it gets a little compulsive, you know, but people literally do that, try to maintain that sense of mindfulness by noting. It's called noting. We don't tend to do that in Zen practice. Not quite spontaneous enough. But try it. Sometimes when you just do it for 10 seconds or 20 seconds. Walking, walking, chewing, chewing. Just, it brings you more mindful into each specific act. And so that's what the sutra is trying to get us to be mindful in every single activity of our day. Then they go on the next two chapters. I'm not going to read to you because it tends to freak out most people. But why? Again, a monk reviews, this very body from the soles of the feet upward and from the scalp downward, enclosed by skin and full of manifest impurities. In this body are the head hairs, the body hairs, the nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bone, marrow bone, kidneys, heart, liver, spleen, lung, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, towels, squall, saliva, saliva fluids, urine, just as there is a bag open at the ends, full of various kinds of grains, such as the... Anyway, this goes on, right? This goes on for like two pages. And then the next one, why are they doing this? Because, like in yoga, yoga is a wonderful practice. I do yoga. I teach yoga to prisoners. I'm not very good at it, but I do it. Because it's a tremendous way to become mindfulness of the body and posture and breathing. It's a tremendous meditation. But there's a little bit of a disadvantage to yoga. If you ever go to a yoga studio, you probably notice that people tend to be a little attached to their bodies. They're a little narcissistic when it comes to, they're very beautiful. They tend to have beautiful people go to yoga studios, you know? And not that we don't have beautiful people here, but some people are more internally beautiful. And the reason why is because what Buddha taught was, well, don't hang on to your body too tightly because it's going to get old and it's going to fall apart, you know. So you don't need to necessarily look forward to that, but you need to understand that's what's going to happen. And if you don't understand that, there's going to be a lot of suffering when things start to fall apart. So the Buddha taught to let go. Where sensual pleasures arise, cultivate attachment. So the two ways that he cultivated attachment was, reflect on the fact of what your body really is. It isn't just a superficial, beautiful thing that you can get really attached to and try to make yourself more and more beautiful. Actually, it's much more complicated than that if you really get into it. So don't just ignore the shadow component of your body. That's what he's teaching you. And the next one he said, and if that doesn't work for you, well, he says, if that doesn't work, you got a little cramp on my leg here. Oh, okay. He says, if that doesn't work, here's a good example of your body working. If that doesn't work for you, then go to the charnel grounds and watch people disintegrate or watch them be burned in case you think you're going to stay the way you are when you're 17 years old.
Where do you go?
The charnel grounds.
Where, what grounds?
The burial grounds.
Burial.
And the way they're either burned or sometimes they were just left out. you know, the Tibetan tradition actually left out. So if you were to go and you watch the body fall apart, those of you, how many people here have been with somebody that's died, that's seen a dead body? Okay, well, you know, within an hour, within 5 minutes, there's a change. Within half an hour, there's a change. Within an hour or 2 hours, there's a big change. And that's very sobering when you see that. When the light goes out, it's a huge change. And that's very sobering. If you never quite look at your body again once you've experienced that. And that's what the Buddha said. He gave these two specific practices. And then the next one is he has a whole section in here about, you know, the repulsiveness of the body. So in the early Theravadan tradition, there's a strong emphasis on this. In the later traditions in the Mahayana, there wasn't such a strong emphasis on this. It was more, in the early ones, because it was the orientation in Buddhist time was much more on being an aesthetic, about withdrawing from the world. And in the later traditions, the Mahayana is much more about being engaged in the world. So you actually quite, you know, don't be, you know, enjoy your body. Enjoy life. It isn't like being removed from it. You enjoy it, but also be able to let go of it because you hold it in the context of impermanence. It's kind of a little bit of a major shift there. Okay, so I'm not reading about 4 pages about the repulsiveness and what you do when you go to the... But you can read that on your own if you're... And it's kind of helpful to do that, okay? Okay. So there's 9 charnel ground contemplations here. For next time you end up in a cemetery, you can do these 9 charnel ground. We don't tend to emphasize this in the thing we do, but we do emphasize the first part, mindfulness of the body. Okay. Now the next one, contemplation of feelings. And how monk does a monk abide contemplating feelings as feelings? So, body sensations arise, right? And then you have feelings. I like that feeling. I don't like that feeling. I'm neutral. I have a feeling, but I don't necessarily like it or I don't like it. So what this contemplation is that you're beginning to be aware of your feelings. Now, I'm going a little slower than I thought. So I would like to end with the Heart Sutra. But let me just say this. The first part of the Heart Sutra says, traditionally, it would be chanted as Avalokiteshvara, who is the Bodhisattva of compassion. When practicing deeply the Prajnaparamita, which is actually this practice, mindfulness practice, right kind of mindfulness. When practicing deeply Prajnaparamita, the wisdom that goes beyond wisdom, because the insight you're gaining in this is going to lead you to an understanding of the interdependence of all things, perceive that we are all empty of a separate self, empty of permanent characteristics and interdependent with all things. That's one translation we're going to... The more traditional one is what he saw was that the all 5 aggregates are empty and thus relieved from suffering. So that's what this sutra is saying. The aggregates are these things. Form is an aggregate. There are 5 aggregates. Form, feeling, perceptions, impulses, and consciousness. These are 5 aggregates that go to make us up. I think I'm Bruce, but really I'm just 5 aggregates. I'm the aggregate of form. I'm the aggregate of all my feelings. I'm the aggregate of my perceptions. I perceive chair. I perceive you. I perceive this. Impulses, which are my responses from my perception, which is, I really don't like that bell, or I do like that bell, or that is a bell and not an orange. That's impulses, or I like it or don't like it. Actually, the first is more perception, like orange or bell. Second one is whether I like it or don't like it. And the third is consciousness, which is the capacity of the mind to put all these together in a formulated state. So I'm getting a little esoteric right now, but basically, what that was is all Vishara saw that he wasn't or she wasn't a person, it was just these aggregates. And what the Heart Sutra does, which is what this sutra tells us, in the foundations of going through and looking at all these things, breaking it down and seeing, okay, let's examine form. Now let's examine perceptions and impulses, which is basically mind states, which we haven't got to yet. And the third is the mind, which is actually consciousness. So they actually condense the five into four. Perceptions and impulses are included under one of the mindfulness states. You don't have to remember all this. But anyway, the idea is, though, that liberation comes from observing this clearly, from beginning to see yourself in this kind of a context. Okay? So, I'm just going to read the first paragraph. So he or she abides contemplating body as bodily internally, contemplating body as body. And how monks does a monk contemplate feelings as feelings? Here a monk feeling a pleasant feeling knows he is feeling a pleasant feeling. Feeling a painful feeling, he knows he is feeling a painful feeling. Feeling a feeling that is neither painful nor pleasant, he or she knows that he or she is feeling a feeling that is neither painful nor pleasant. Feeling a pleasant, sensational feeling, sensual feeling, he knows he is feeling a pleasant, sensual feeling. They're making a little distinction here between feelings that are cardinal, which give rise to more greed, and spiritual feelings, which are more refined, actually. A pleasant, non-sensual feeling. He knows that he feels a pleasant, non-sensual feeling. Making a distinction there. Feeling a painful sensational. So in other words, you're just aware of what kind of feelings you have, right? Which may be related to physical, your physical sensations, or it may be related to some mental factor, which we haven't got. So, that gives us a lot to work with, right? Mm-hmm. We could just pay attention to the breath, the in-breath and the out-breath, and then that'll lead us to everything else. So let's chant the Heart Sutra together. Let's see how 400 years later they take this and actually move it to the next, kind of the next level about, well, don't even hang on to these aggregates. These aren't fixed either. Let them go. Let everything go. Liberate yourself. Liberate yourself completely. Let go. Svaha. Just let go. So, we're going to do some bow.